Welcome, I'm Craig Sutledge, and our topic today is the ordained ministry, and we'll be talking about what are some of the facets of pastoral leadership in the church today. I'm on the staff of the Division for Ministry of the ELCA in Chicago, and before that, as I just said to you, I was a parish pastor. We have been this week, and also I must comment, if anyone listens to this tape in the future, it's a very hot Friday afternoon in Holden Village in August, so we have to put it in context. Thermometer outside our port says 84. I don't know if that's right, but it feels even warmer than that. We have been talking this week about, first of all, God's call to ministry. I think that we've had some good conversation together these last couple of weeks, in fact, about the meaning of call and vocation, ministry. We've talked about the ministry of the baptized in the world, and we've talked about varieties of ministry in the ELCA last time, especially on various lay ministries. So that leaves today the ordained ministry. And I know the two of you were in Walt's session this morning. Were you in Walt Bowman's session this morning? You were working, probably. Walt Bowman had a wonderful session, I thought, on the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, and its relationship to ministry. And he said several things that I'd been saying during the week. I think I mentioned to him after the session that we had not coordinated at all, but we did raise some of the same issues. I want to begin this afternoon by reading two quotes from Luther. One in which he refers to the ministry of the baptized relative to called ministry, and then it kind of flips it around. It's two different quotes, one from the Babylonian captivity of the churches. Luther writes, "We are all priests, as many of us as are Christians, but the priests, as we call them, are ministers chosen from among us." And then from his commentary on Psalm 82, "It is true that all Christians are priests, but they are not all pastors. Over and above that, he, or we would say now he or she, is a Christian and priest, but he must also have an office and a field of work that has been committed to his charge." So for Luther, it wasn't that the priesthood of believers took the place of the priesthood or the called ministry. And that was supported then later in the writing of the Augsburg Confession. Oh, I should have mentioned, too, that Luther, in another writing that he had, listed the office of ministry as the fifth mark of the church. I want to get this right here, my notes. He says that... Well, he said it somewhere. He listed it after after the Word of God, sacraments, and the absolution, the office of ministry. In the Augsburg Confession, the reference is in Article 5. After the Augsburg Confession talks about justification by grace through faith, it has this sentence or this paragraph on ministry. "To obtain such faith," that is the faith, the forgiveness of sins, of the justification by faith, "to obtain such faith, God instituted the office of the ministry," that is, provided the gospel and the sacraments. "Through these, as through means, God gives the Holy Spirit, who works faith when and where he pleases in those who hear the gospel. And the gospel teaches that we have a gracious God, not by our own merits, but by the merit of Christ when we believe this." What is interesting is how little the writings of Luther and the Augsburg Confession, or the whole Book of Concord, have about ministry. They pretty much assumed the structure of ministry that existed in the 16th century. Luther wanted to reform the church. He saw the reform of the bishops as being critical. But in terms of the basic structure of what was then called the priesthood or the pastor, the Luther and the Reformers didn't say a whole lot because they assumed a great deal of continuity. But I'd like to begin this afternoon getting from you one of the things that I do in fact, I do spend a lot of my time doing this in the ELCA, is talking about what are the qualities in candidates, in persons, that the church needs for leadership, both ordained and lay. And that's important to candidates, and it's important to the church. It's important to all of us. And I must spend, a significant amount of time with candidacy committees discussing with them what are the qualities we look for, what are the things we need. And I do that so that candidacy committees not be idiosyncratic, that is to say that each individual committee has its own particular hobby horse that it likes to ride about pastors and associates in ministry. And what I try to suggest is that there is, in fact, a shared understanding throughout the Lutheran Church of some of the characteristics and qualities that we need in pastoral leadership. I'd like to ask you if you could identify some things. If you'd name maybe the top three, maybe we could do that. If you could, in your own mind, sort through for a few moments, what are the qualities, the characteristics, the abilities that you think is most important for a pastor in the life of the ELCA? And let's try to I'll put those up on the board if you'll just give them to me. Top three.
About spirituality.
Okay, spirituality. Could you say anything more about that? I mean, that's a fairly broad term.
Sure, and that may be, in fact, a heading with, as different from the more secular qualities.
Okay.
Spirituality, which is clearly an understanding and a feeling and a part of the spirit filled, maybe would be a better
okay. Spirit-filled. Let's use that as a kind of a qualifier to what you just said. All right. What else?
An ability to articulate a Christian faith.
Okay. Ability to articulate Christian faith.
Mm-hmm. Over on the other side, it's hard to just conclude because some are the human qualities and just ordinary human qualities, which is someone who has an ability to attract and inspire, who's has that outgoing interpersonal skills.
Okay.
Not charisma carries some baggage with it.
I think there's a difference between charisma and
the interpersonal.
Not that
skills.
That's not nice. And so,
It's interesting how the Greek word charism means gifts. It referred in the New Testament to gifts of the Spirit. Charisma in secular language is often used by a person who has a kind of a magnetic personality, personality that inspires, motivates, draws. And then charismatic, which is a very good word, has become so narrowly defined that it's a problem. But I'm going to put charisms, which really, of course, refers to everything, but I'll use it in this context or those kind of personal, that a person not be off-putting. I guess the reverse side would be someone who is off-putting in his or her personality. What else?
Well, how do you, I don't know how to say it, but organizational skills, which means delegation. I'm mobilizing the laity. I don't know what word you used.
Leadership organization.
Well, in leadership, sometimes I think people get me, I am the leader. And they think,
but that's not how it's a cooperative working together.
Well, what was Walt talking about this morning?
Galvanizing the others.
Yeah.
Sending it forth.
Okay. Equipping the, not just that,
galvanizing the congregation is what he's really talking about. Or whatever setting the pastor is serving in.
Yes, galvanizing the group, whatever it is.
Well, we've said everything except walk on water.
Oh no, there's a lot more before walking on water. Sometimes committee, I'll end up with a list that'll be 30 characteristics, 30 or 40 characteristics.
That gets to be kind of...
Which get to be a bit much. I mean, but I would say, and I agree with you, ability to articulate the Christian faith presumes a knowledge of the Christian faith. You can't articulate something you don't know. So I think this is based on the assumption that there's first of all knowledge.
Well, you know, the very first thing that the Constitution says, that ordained minister shall preach the word.
Right.
And that ability to preach is something that sometimes gets downplayed, but indeed that's probably the central skill that a pastor should have.
I'm going to play off that. We talk about functions, and I think Walt's lecture this morning, his discussion, was very helpful in, again, focusing on what is primary in a pastor's task. And that, again, is an illustration of what we were talking about the other day, of the history in the Lutheran Church is to lump so much into the role of the pastor that it doesn't, first of all, it's impossible. No one person can do it all. And secondly, it doesn't recognize that there are other individuals besides the pastor who can do some of those things. And so you end up diluting what is primary and it not being done very well.
Well, and worse than that, you get the call to the pastor. In other words, when he leaves, then families leave the church. Well, were they into Christianity or were they into the pastor?
Right.
So you've got to avoid that.
Right. We were talking the other day in here about structures that might reinforce renewing the ministry of all baptized, and I thought this morning that the segment of the liturgy where he was talking about the assisting minister and the prayer really opened up the possibility of a structure that would reorganize.
Yes, I thought so too, sir.
That was very interesting.
I thought it was excellent. In fact, I said to Rachel that I'm going to get that today's lecture or presentation from Walt, give it to our pastor, pastor of our congregation.
Can you really quickly say what that was?
Yeah, Sue, please, go ahead.
He did some discussion about liturgy and gathering, but talking, I'll make it short here, about liturgy as the work of the people, and that the assisting minister should not be the ordained associate pastor, but a lay person. And that part of that person's work at the time of the prayers is to actually gather the prayers from the congregation at the moment, and that he actually called the time of the prayers of the church the business of the congregation, or the
agenda.
The agenda of the...
And then the action.
Who's responsible for this?
Yes. And the person to gather was specifically not only what are prayer concerns, but then who is attending to those prayer concerns, which to me opened up a lot of possibility for we all together are responsible for. That would be a structure that would reinforce that on a weekly basis, every week, and we come back to the work of the people in that particular.
It's worth listening to. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm guessing that you meet people who say, at the point of entry and say, I would like to be a candidate for the seminary. You sit in an hour, correct?
I meet many people like that, yes.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to sort it out. And then do they say, I think I'd like to be a pastor, or do they say, I would like to be a leader and bring other people in to know about Christ?
I think most persons are directed toward ordained ministry without a very clear knowledge of the other possibilities. So they often talk only about being a pastor.
I thought that...
I don't mean other pastors. I mean the I, and you get my... The I approach, or the idea that I want to get in there and help bring others along. Or I've my own life has been, I'm at a great crossroads, and I think I want to go into ministry.
Yeah, I think it's often that, and I think it takes being in a program of preparation where you begin to see what this is going to lead to. And there's a wonderful quote from Edward Skillebeck, a Roman Catholic theologian, that says, you don't become a minister to become a minister. In other words, you don't become a minister to fulfill that, to have that identity. You become a minister to do ministry. And what we have to help people understand is that it's not the identity, I'm a pastor, or I'm an associate minister, or I'm a deaconess, or I'm a whatever. It's what you do through that ministry that's important. Let's go back to this list. You have this the ELCA stuff. What is the very first basic standard? And it's we're all assuming this, but
goodness
to Christ. Yeah, goodness to Christ. I know you all knew that, but that is, it's obvious. But then again, someone today at breakfast, we were talking about what a Presbyterian congregation has done in terms of visualizing the ministry of the congregation by having a little card printed up, and it uses the word commitment in several places. And the person who was sharing this said one of her friends, who belonged to another church body, not Presbyterian and not Lutheran, was saying how she didn't think that was a very good idea because people don't want to commit.
Yeah, people are.
And in fact, that is one of the appeals of some of the mega churches, is that there is no commitment. There is no commitment. So the word commitment is more than simply saying, well, you know, it's more than just a piety. It's a real commitment. But okay, I think that what we've identified here now into Christ, spirit-filled or spirit-led knowledge of and ability to articulate the Christian faith, interpersonal skills. Actually, we're pretty much covering without you seeing it ahead of time, some of the stuff that you've already identified is in the church's concerns. One of the things that we're trying to correct these days in the 90s in preparation for ministry in the 21st century is to emphasize the aspect of leadership, and not leadership in the sense of, you know, I am the boss, but leadership in effect that will motivate and lead people. Because for many years the metaphor for ministry was often seen as the interpersonal caregiver, the facilitator. It was much more of a let's see where the group wants to go and then we'll go that direction, as opposed to here is the word, here is our task, here is our mission, and how can we get there? So we are really emphasizing in this last part of the 20th century, of this decade, leadership as being a prime requisite. Is someone able to lead people? Now, if that is a legitimate concern, then as we begin to look at what does a pastor do, we should be able to understand what is the central role of the pastor. And we've talked about this in other settings, but remember we talked about in worship we gather the people, and Walt was saying some of this today without really saying it this way. We gather the people, we share the word of God, we share the meal, gather the table, and then we are sent into the world as the people of God. The central task of the pastor, I would say to you, is to proclaim the word, the apostolic message, the gospel. What is unique about ordained leadership is that ordained leadership in the Lutheran Church assumes and is built upon the fact that the pastor is knowledgeable of the scriptures, can tell the biblical story, understands the Christian tradition, that is the apostolic Catholic faith, and can proclaim that word in a cogent, compelling way that allows people to connect that word with their lives, so that the individual who hears that word not only hears the scriptural story, but understands how that story impacts upon his or her life.
Well, that's a very important point, because you get pastors of a previous generation, and they sometimes, we had one that used to clip and paste and put a sermon together, and others would talk about other things, but now we have one that talks directly about our lives, and that's the one we like the best.
Yeah.
And we're getting most out of, I should say, like the best, but the one we gain the most from, the spirituality and the connection with what the word says. And I think sometimes pastors preach the word and never make the personal connection.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think we pastors can err on, we can either fall on the side of simply doing a running commentary on life in 1995 and whatever else has happened, kind of a, this is a commentary on today's world, what's happened this week, folks, or these are stories of my life, aren't they interesting, or just tell the Bible story and never make a connection. I think it's both.
That's a unique skill that doesn't necessarily just happen naturally.
That's right.
It really needs to be learned.
And there are people, and this goes back to this variety of ministries, there are people who can know the word and who can teach the word and who can carry out very important ministries of service, but who are not called to that proclamation and therefore should not be serving as pastors or should not be
seeking. That's where you get some of the seminary professors. Mm-hmm. They can teach.
Administrators.
Not necessarily parish pastors.
Maybe it's because their interest is in the word, their interest is in the history, their interest is in the curriculum and not the persons. Some people more people-oriented, they're interested in people more than, and some people, school teachers and educational are like that. Some are great for their education and they're all into Shakespeare. But as far as the ghetto kids or somebody else coming who need to be educated, they're out of their depth. Teachers have their preference, which way.
You know, when we talk about the skill of proclaiming the word, just it almost instantly set off a train of thought that in the 21st century, maybe we're not talking about individual pastors in local congregations. Given the satellite capabilities, all of the electronic media. Now, I was at a conference about a year ago where we were in a three-way conversation with people in Los Angeles, in a couple of other locations, and we were seeing them and talking back and forth to them without being physically present. And it struck me that maybe that's something that the church needs to begin to think about.
We're doing better than that. We have it in reality. You might be interested in knowing that we've already begun to link, use both satellite, which is more expensive, and compressed digital technology. And don't even ask me what that means, but it's something about it's compressing everything down into the wires the telephone system has already. We will have operating this fall three of our seminaries and one seminary extension, all linked through this compressed digital technology that will allow a professor in Chicago to have a class in Columbus, Ohio, Dubuque, Iowa, and Austin, Texas, and have people talk in real time back and forth. In other words, when I speak to you, my words are being heard at the exact same moment, 1,000 miles away, and a person can ask a question back.
Are they also going to be able to see us? That was we were at Rockwell international, so, you know, we have technology that's way out there.
We've had some of that too. No, I think that's in fact that part of our...
And that's something that is coming, and the seminaries need to start.
Yep.
But I'm interested in this, of course, I realize the topic of the day we're discussing. However, to digress a bit, it's been said sometimes that the generals of West Point train the soldiers to lead the last war, and maybe seminaries train people to lead churches of the 1950s or whatever. And my next question is, does the church have a group, a think tank for the future to project what it's going to be, so that when you're looking for people of this nature, they can fit right in to the world we're going to be living in?
I was just reading today, yes, the answer is yes, that the report of the executive administrator of the ELCA, one of Bishop Chilstrom's assistants, the chief executive officer of the churchwide organization, has his report is all about changing models of ministry and denominations and all that. So yes, there are people who are thinking a great deal about that. I think, in my judgment, the congregation will continue to be the primary setting for ministry.
Yes, that's true, there's a primary setting, but maybe the preaching or the proclaiming of the word may be coming from someone else while the congregation is this community that is doing their faith in the world, but maybe the proclaiming of the word may be coming from someone else, some other location.
Do you think that would be possible in terms of then the kind of...
What about administering the sacraments? And, you know,
well, that's true, that the ministry of the sacraments, but the proclaiming of the word may be coming in a different way. Now, it's entirely possible, and I think we ought to be thinking about those things, because I suspect that 50 years down the road, we're going to say, what do you mean you have individual pastors preparing sermons every week? Nope.
Yeah.
It's just like we are saying now, what do you mean you had somebody riding a 5-point parish on horseback? It happened in the Middle West. It's almost still there.
Mm-hmm.
In some parishes.
Dual parishes and triple parishes and whatever.
On the other hand, maybe the refuge from a high-tech world like that will be the sense of personal community, mm-hmm. of the church.
And I
think so too.
Interrupt you, but I think that is in the teaching profession, you know, we could set up all these kids on these computers and, you know, have push buttons and stuff, and it wouldn't have to be in person.
You need that human interaction.
That's
but
right.
the skillful lesson, whatever that lesson is,
right,
could be coming from outside the classroom, but you have the teacher there to help do some other things.
Oh, that's true.
And that's where the leadership of the pastor would come in to help the congregation do other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think that's possible.
Sure. I think it would be a loss on a full-time basis, though, because I think a good pastor who's preaching really incorporates the life of that community into that Sunday morning proclamation. And, you know, maybe we could have enrichment.
I was going to say, our pastor not only preaches an excellent sermon, but she teaches Bible study that carries the same proclamation of the word, but it's done in a teaching setting as well.
You can do a lot of preaching by interaction too with different individuals in the community. And it's not just that sermon on Sunday morning.
You say that proclaiming of the word is not just the sermon.
Well, no, I
no?
Disagree.
Okay,
because you go come to California, come to the suburbs, you come to the cities, the flock is scattered. We never see each other from one Sunday to the next. We're all a little bit. Therefore, the Sunday morning service is preeminent. You get the people come and they make up their mind the first, 20 minutes or so. in terms of the first impressions. Evangelist studies tell you that. And anyway, we need that, because otherwise, we never see each other in our daily lives.
So and you're totally not a community, as in, you know, shared
no.
things in any
now, way. That's out there. That's a different world than back in the West, where you see the guy in the, you know, the barber shop Monday and the, yeah. And the Tuesday and the way. So, but the church has got to contend with that too. We need your help out there in coping with the kind of environment and the people we have.
Well, I think the point that Walt was making today in terms of the link between communion and ministry is a very important one. Whatever else happens during the week, and I suppose the models do vary from congregations where that is the primary social setting. We had people here in earlier sessions, you remember, who talked about the congregation being their primary social setting. Mm-hmm. You have, on the one hand, that, to what you're describing, where there is little, if any, contact between members during the work week.
Well, that overstates the case, but I'm saying little contact other than the church. I mean, we're scattered all over our
community. We don't see right. each other. Right. As in, people go to work, you're not running into Joe Doe, who sits in the pew.
No, and that would probably be typical. Right. That would be yeah. typical of most congregations. But the point is that the one thing that sets the church apart from any other institution is what we do together on Sunday or whenever else we worship. We come together consciously as a people, gather together, hear the word proclaimed in both scripture and sermon, Bible study, and the word in the sacraments. Luther would talk about the word being received in the sacraments. And then because of what we do in that setting together, we then are empowered, equipped to do our ministry in daily life. So the ministry, the ordained ministry, its primary function is within the priesthood of believers. The primary focus of ordained ministry is within the context of the believing community. It's true that pastors, ordained persons, also seek to invite others, the witness to the world, the outreach, the evangelism. But that can't be done only by the ordained minister. And that can be done by others. That's the point. Others can do that. There are things which only the pastor is called and prepared to do. And so in a congregation that's healthy, that's clear that the pastor is not someone who's trying to do every single thing in the life of that congregation or community, but is focused on that word. And again, some of it you see in the ELC documents in kind of dry constitutional language, but its focus must be upon what the community of believers is hearing and receiving in the context of worship and its life. And then what's important to realize is that while the priesthood of believers is the context in which public ministry functions, it's not the basis of that ministry. That is to say that ordained persons receive through ordination the authority which Christ gave his disciples. So there is that divine institution of the office of ministry that says the pastor is more than, other than, simply a servant of the congregation. She or he has the authority of Christ in the office of ministry. And that's the balance that can be skewed.
But the pity is then you get, in the Lutheran tradition, you get a strong church council that says this is our congregation, this is our church.
Walt talked about some of that today. Sure.
The pastor is our employee.
And yes, and that's the pastor is accountable to the congregation, but also to the larger church. See, in the ELCA, it's very clear that an ordained minister is not simply accountable to the congregation he or she serves, but is accountable to the whole church. the congregation calls, employs the pastor is accountable to the congregation, but that is not a closed relationship. It's the bishop representing the synod is involved in that equation, and ultimately the whole church is involved in terms of the standards that we have for pastors, the requirements of preparation that we have, and the kind of constitutional language that every pastor is obliged to do, whether or not the congregation is even aware of it, and many are not. So I think the ELCA does a fairly good job of living out the reality of seeing that while the congregation is the primary context for the ordained, it doesn't create the ordained. The ordained minister or the pastor is not the creation of the congregation. That's maybe the best way of putting it. It's different than that. And this one I was looking for before. It's on the councils in the church. Luther listed the office of ministry as a fifth mark of the church after the word, baptism, Lord's Supper, and absolution. He said the ordained ministry is in fact a mark of the church, divinely instituted by God. A lot of Lutherans coming out of our American context in which the minister is either self-authenticating or simply an employee of the congregation don't understand that kind of language. It's different than many main denominations. The document that our seminary students are all aware of, and so are our pastors, entitled Vision and Expectations. I didn't have a copy with me. I usually have a copy in my briefcase, and I must have given the last one away. That's a document that says what are the expectations of the church, of pastors. And I don't have the document, but I just, from my memory, I can tell you what the sections are. There's a section on call to ordain ministry, in which what is affirmed is that the pastor is someone called by God through the church, and that call is an understanding of a call to a corporate ministry, not an individualistic. In other words, that a pastor does not become a lone ranger. Then there's a whole section on the apostolic faith, the Word of God, the confession of faith that I have up there. The pastor is called to believe, teach, confess, and proclaim the scriptures and the confessions. Believe, teach, confess, and proclaim the scriptures and confessions.
Do you have any candidates that fall by the wayside on those points?
Some, yes. Yes. There's a third section on the pastor as person and example. And there's a section on the ordained minister as witness. Witness to the unity of the church, witness to the gospel in the world. And so it's high expectations. It's not walking on water, but it's expectations that are high enough that all of us who are pastors have to judge our own ministries against that and say, that's a challenge. There's a challenge there. There really is.
But then we get the feeling that the burden is ours, and pretty quickly get down the burnout trail. Which is overstating, I know.
I think it is. I think I don't think the church, again, asks of its pastors more than the church asks of itself. What is different is that it's so much more public. Pastors are not asked to believe more than the baptized. They are asked to be able to proclaim better, to confess the faith better, but they're not asked in terms of being as a person or an example different.
Aren't they an almost an unwritten expectation, perhaps? But are they not expected to live a little more exemplary life than the rest of us?
Well, that's what I'm trying to put a different cast on it.
I mean, I understand that all of us are expected to meet that standard.
Yeah.
But as a practical matter,
we're held accountable in a different way. That is true. What has to be true is that the pastor must live a life that's no less than what we ask of Christians, and often because it's so public, there is a more public character to it. And so when a pastor fails, as pastors often do, as we all do, the consequence can be more severe, and therefore the accountability is greater. And we have that. Almost anyone in a public profession, including the President of the United States, can go through a divorce, a bad divorce, and get through it professionally, and many times a pastor cannot. She or he just doesn't survive. That's an example. And the public character is, I think, for most seminary students, I know it was for me as a young pastor, one of the most difficult things, because you are suddenly put into a much more public place. I think, frankly, it's the same thing we're seeing with speaking of our politicians. A generation ago, what the president did in private was his own business, and no one reported it. Yeah, well, or John Kennedy, even more recently. And now that is very different. And I think that that is paralleled. I think ministers have not been sheltered in quite the same way as politicians have been, but in a sense they were. The Roman Catholic Church is paying a large price, both in terms of its prestige and dollars, in terms of covering up the problem of pedophilia among some priests. So that is changing too. Yes, sir.
Well, I think that we may be something a little backwards here. I think that the church councils of our
You're talking about congregational councils now. I was going to be sure you're yes.
Not the large.
Not the big council, but the congregation council.
When we think about out west, that's the church council.
Local only.
Yeah.
We don't know where Chicago is.
Yeah, most people talk about church council.
The people everywhere on the church councils, I think, should be conditioned and trained and educated and suggested and reminded of what their reasonable expectations should be in terms of having a pastor. It's all well and good, I think, for us or even the candidate or everybody up here to know, but if your church council is operating on a totally different wavelength, you got problems.
I've suggested, thank you for saying that, I've suggested to newly ordained pastors that they sit down with their congregational councils with the vision and expectation document and talk, this is what the church expects. Are these different than what you expect? And to have clarity. I think one of the biggest problems can be with a young pastor, a new pastor, is different expectations, where the pastor thinks she or he knows what the expectations are, and the congregation has quite different ones. So if I were going into a congregation now, I should say a new pastor in a congregation, no matter how old you are or how long you've been a pastor, if I had a call to a congregation now, I would very early on, probably in the first month or two, sit down and say, here's the expectations that the church has of me, here's what I understand the call to be, what do you understand it to be? And then talk about those expectations. And be very clear so that people don't assume that one of the pastor's jobs is to be sure that all the windows are closed after service or that the heat's turned on at the right time. You know, I'm being trivial, but whatever it is.
Those are the things that bring down.
Yeah. We just went through with our pastor, she's been there 4 years now. And that she says to a group I was working with her on it, I'm uncomfortable because I'm not sure that anyone knows what the church expects of me, her, you know, she's speaking, or whether I am, you know, my own expectations that we have to work this out so that there is an evaluation against those expectations, because they're not clear. It says the letter of call is pretty much the standard stuff that's in here.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing beyond that. So she's working on that now. It's after 4 years of it. But, you know, this was her first independent pastor, and I think she's realized all that when she goes to another congregation, new congregation, she's going to do that right off.
But I think you should go back to Chicago and tell from the top down and tell them, your colleagues there and that division, to get something going and get the word out along this line of this whole, let's get the expectations adjusted.
Well, that's what was part of our intent with the vision and expectations document. It was sent to every pastor in the ELCA when it was published. We may have to send it out again, but the point is...
Get it to the layman, get it to the council. It's got to come down at that level some way.
One of the hardest things to do is to get the local leadership to see that there is more responsibility than coming once a month to say yay or nay.
At a meeting,
and leaving almost all the rest of it to the pastor.
Sue?
There are also, in fact, expectations for council members printed in the ELCA model.
That's true, yes.
And people are quite startled when they're elected to a council to realize that they have not only committee responsibility, but leadership and spiritual responsibility to the congregation as examples and witnesses.
Yeah.
And I think that in an early relationship, it would be useful for a pastor.
Yes, that's great.
To remind of church council that there are expectations of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the resources are out there. It's a matter of getting it. I think you might want to just note what Sue just said, that if you look at the, I don't know how closely your congregation's constitution follows the model constitution, well, then some of that stuff is in there, yeah.
There's a lot. It's amazing what's in there, really. It's not something you ever really go through, except there's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of... Not the legalities of it all, that's fine, you say that in 10 minutes, but I'm giving out expectations otherwise. I will say that in our, what we called our woman pastor, 35 years old, a woman, you know, when I was on the committee, and I said, you know, if I can make two leaps of faith, the rest of the people can make it. So we're going like gangbusters. But in the process then, we said in the beginning, our demographics are such that in 10 years we'll all be, you know, in the great beyond. And therefore we need younger people and to keep the congregation going. We need emphasis. We want to bring in young families. So it's happened. And 20 children, 25 come down every Sunday morning for children's service. So that's an expectation that we have, that she has, that we all agree on.
And it was made clear.
And it's working. And we're happy. She said the other day, you folks realize that at the service the other day, besides myself, everyone participating was under 21 years of age. I said, well, we never noticed. Because you see, age isn't in the picture with us. It's they're all communicants, we're all Christians together, we don't care.
Yes, but the average age when she came was over 60.
In the congregation.
Which is an interesting set of demographics, that there was a single expectation, which perhaps was good. She's now uncomfortable because she feels that single expectation, perhaps there are other things out there that have been unspoken and perhaps need to be recognized, but that one expectation was very clear. But, you know, that's usually not enough.
This is a shift, but I recently saw a pamphlet talking about covenant clusters referring to seminaries, but there was no address as to where this came from.
I can tell you what.
It's a very generic kind of introduction. More will be coming. Can you say a little
sure
about what that is? Or
I'd be happy to. I was going to suggest that we can probably just make it kind of a general forum now and just have some broad discussion. A part of the report of the task force studying theological education in the ELCA, one of the significant things that has already occurred is that the 8 seminaries of the ELCA have now formed 3 clusters across the church. There is an eastern cluster of Philadelphia, Gettysburg, and Southern Seminary, there is a what's now being called Covenant Cluster of Trinity, the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and Wartburg Seminary. And then there is the, I think it's called the Mission Cluster of Luther Seminary in St. Paul and Pacific Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley. The intent is that over the next few years, those three clusters will develop one governance for each cluster. That is, instead of having eight boards and eight governances that we have now, we'll end up with three, and that there'll be economy achieved in terms of how programs are delivered and so forth, and that while each seminary will continue to offer an MDiv track for ordained ministers, candidates for ordained ministry, that each cluster will have certain specializations that will not be duplicated elsewhere. It's an attempt to avoid duplicating programs, so that one cluster will have the diaconal ministry program, for example. Another cluster may have the graduate degree, graduate study program. Another cluster may have something else. So that's the intent, and it's really moving along quite quickly. At the beginning of the study, there were people who said, we're not sure we need eight seminaries. And the way they're distributed is not quite the demographics of the whole country and all that. And after doing the study, what the task force has concluded, and I believe the church will find out in 2 weeks, is to say that we don't need to close seminaries. What we need to do is this clustering and then use them for more than simply training pastors and lay leaders, but to use them to provide theological education for the church. And a part of that is the technology that you raised earlier. A part of that will be the use of interactive video teleconferencing as a way of delivering courses. A very concrete example, we have a seminary extension in Austin, Texas, that will now, beginning this fall, be able to utilize lectures in Chicago, Dubuque, or Columbus, Ohio, and thus draw upon a much richer resource of faculty than they can with a very small program there. We also are likely to use the same technology to beam programs for theological education for laity down to the valley in Texas. I'm involved in a strategy right now of how to develop lay ministries among Mexican Americans along the U.S.-Mexico border. South Texas and Southern California have heavy concentrations of Hispanic people. We don't have the people trained to do ministry in the Hispanic language. So what we're going to be using for the foreseeable future will be a fairly large number of lay persons, not seminary educated, to be evangelist and catechist among the Hispanic community with some supervision by pastors until we have more pastors who are able to do this. I got off on a tangent, but the point is that there really is a lot of ferment going on. There's a lot of stuff happening that a lot of people aren't aware of that will mean that our theological education resources will be deployed and utilized in a much better way than they have been before. And the clustering is kind of foundational to that whole thing.
What happens as candidates can be in my synod? But normally this would all be done before you enter seminary. So I'm doing it backwards.
But there will be people like you, Suzanne,
right,
who will say, I'd like to just do some theology, I'm not sure what I want to do.
Right.
And then they'll say, oh, I'm beginning to understand the call, and this is what I want to do. Suzanne experience, what we say happens usually is that someone else will say to a person, I think you ought to be a pastor. That's what happened, right, Suzanne?
It happened with more than one person.
Yeah.
Continually throughout the years.
I'm surprised. I always thought it was that all of this testing would come ahead of time, and once that was all passed, then the person would go to the seminary.
Well, that's that is the
that's the. She did it backwards, but she got.
But how did she get the seminary in the first place?
Well, well, I was going to just go and get a Master of Divinity, and, but without the plan of being ordained.
Oh,
and so
I
then
see.
You don't have to do any of that stuff.
Oh, that can be done.
You just go.
Yeah,
seminary.
And she was at Harvard, Harvard Divinity.
Harvard, Harvard, right. They don't mind if you just come because you're interested. So
what we do this, there's actually two tracks. If I'm at the beginning and my pastor or someone else has said has encouraged me and now I'm saying, okay, I've made the decision, I want to start. What do? I do two things. First of all, and it may be the timing is not that critical, but I contact my synod office and the synod sends me an application for candidacy. And I complete that, and then as Suzanne was saying, there's an initial interview, which is primarily information gathering about family of origin, educational background, work history, and all that. There's a psychological and career evaluation, and there's a meeting with a committee or a part of the committee in which they now make an entrance decision that says, Suzanne or Craig have a potential for ordained ministry or roster lead ministry, and we think they're ready to begin theological study. Or they can say, you're not ready, you've got to work on this or that. At the same time, same parallel track, I apply to a seminary, complete their application process, and they make an admissions decision. Is this person a person we think who can do the academic work? But that evaluation by a seminary is almost entirely limited to academic potential, as opposed to the other pieces. So in the ELCA, we have a parallel track that goes along. And at the entrance point, the two institutions make decisions pretty much apart from each other. At endorsement, which is at the beginning or the first part of the second year of seminary, the seminary and committee cooperate on that. And at the very end, the same thing happens. The seminary faculty make a recommendation to the candidacy committee whether this person should be approved for rostered ministry or not. So it's a very careful process.
There is some screening, or I don't want to say screening out, but some direct
ordination. What would you end up with? What degree?
Well, if a person, I mean, a person can get at any divinity school, I mean, a Harvard or a Claremont or whatever, can get an MDiv degree without any ecclesial.
That's what Roman Catholic do all the time.
Yeah, right. In our ELCA schools, some of our seminaries will do that, others will not. But you have is a degree. You do not have, you're not prepared to go into a congregation.
I understand that very well, but I only wonder what the name of the degree was.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's Master of Divinity.
Okay.
That's the standard degree. It's a 3-year degree.
Ordained
track. And the lay track is an MTS, an MA, or an MAR. It's a master's degree, a 2-year degree. Master of Theological Studies, right. It's a 2-year degree instead of a 3-year degree.
It's a typical master's program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you remember, if you were at the session, for diaconal ministers and deaconesses, it's that 2-year master's level now that's required. For MDiv or for pastors, it's a 3-year degree, but it's actually a 4-year program for us because we require a year of internship. And for associates in ministry, it's only a bachelor's degree plus additional hours in theology. So our leadership still, and this is one of the issues that people will raise and question and criticize, our leadership still is academically fairly highly trained overall.